This podcast is part of the Acast Creator Network.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes. Nice
dress. It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to The Stand with Eamon Dunphy. Now, the latest development in the increasingly tense relationship between the United States and China saw the United States order the closure of China's consulate in Houston, Texas, overnight. They accused the Chinese in the consulate of stealing intellectual property, and they ordered its immediate closure. It was a strong response from China, but it was also remarkably a fire that started soon after this order that was processed, and clearly the people in this consulate were burning what may be sensitive papers. We're joined now from China by Peter Goff, who reports for the Irish Times on Hong Kong and East Asia in general. And Peter reported on this development in this morning's paper. Peter, the closure of the consulate and the ensuing fire was interesting in itself. What could they possibly have been burning?
Yes, I mean, it was certainly a dramatic escalation of tensions. What they were burning, they say they were burning documentation from the embassy that would have been, secret document, not for public consumption. They say they accused the American side of interfering with shipments and diplomatic pouches coming to and from the their embassies and their consulates. So they said they could not trust the American side to dispatch this sort of these materials back to China or to another consulate or to the embassy in Washington. So that's what they say. It looked obviously the optics were very interesting. That it was a Tuesday afternoon. The consulate was informed they had 72 hours to get out of the premises, or they'd be evicted at 4 p.m. on Friday. And then a few hours later, neighbors called the firefighters in Houston, Texas, saying that there were plumes of smoke in the neighborhood, that the air was black with smoke. And when firefighters and police came to the scene, they weren't allowed access to the consulate. That's the consul general's right as Chinese territory, but it wouldn't let them in. But from video footage taken from a neighbor's house at a high level, you could see several officials in the courtyard with what looked like seven or eight different rubbish bins and burning documentation in the rubbish bins in advance of their evacuation on Friday.
Now, this is a relatively minor matter in the context of greater differences over Hong Kong, Huawei, the coronavirus itself indeed, and indeed over trade and in the South China Sea, the status of Taiwan and the aggression of the Chinese in general, which has really been quite remarkable. It's not so long ago, Peter, since from Ireland, Bertie Ahern was a regular visitor to China. In Britain, in the previous Tory government led by David Cameron and George Osborne, who was the Chancellor of the Exchequer, there was talk of a golden era in relations between China and Britain. And there's a very famous clip of President Xi having a pint in a pub with David Cameron. So all was good and happy. And it seemed as if Britain in particular would have a mutually beneficial relationship with China. Where did that whole project go wrong? Was it a massive misreading by the British government of China's real intentions?
The general prognosis seems to be that Western governments in general were pretty naive compared when taking China's growth into account, starting back from 2001 when many countries pushed for their accession to WTO and thought there would be great benefits in having China in the global trade order. And this was obviously coming in the aftermath of the Tiananmen massacre and egregious human rights violations within China. The general perception at the time was that if they got engaged in the global trade order and joined the international sort of systems and so on, that slowly they would change and start to sort of follow sort of world standards. What has happened, of course, in the intervening decades is that China's got richer and richer, and it hasn't changed its behavior. If anything, it's become more assertive and more aggressive. And we see this everywhere, from how they treat the minorities in Xinjiang and Tibet, and then how the aggression in the South China Sea, now how they've totally clamped down in Hong Kong, and just generally across as they export their sort of form of governance internationally. We see this, and people are sort of slowly waking up to the fact that China is not going to become like us, which some might have hoped they would have, and it's going to. It has very much its own belief system, its own beliefs. It has full confidence in this system and beliefs, and frankly thinks that the world should become more like China rather than the other way around. To continue the David Cameron and the Xi Jinping story there, that same day, just to show you how the Cold War situation is evolving to today, is on that trip, after he had the pint and the fish and chips and so on, he went to Manchester City, and he had a great photo opportunity with Aguero there in the stadium. It was a huge thing that was broadcast on Chinese media for many, many times over the years. But last night now, as this dispute between the UK and China plummets, the Premiership was taken off the air for the first time. So the big game between Liverpool and Chelsea was pulled. Hundreds of millions of Chinese football fans would have been glued to that, and it was pulled at the last minute in direct response to the Johnson government's behaviour towards China, over Huawei, over how they treated the situation in Hong Kong post the national security law. And then also there was a kind of humiliating experience. I don't know if that was seen by many there on BBC last Sunday morning, when the Chinese ambassador to the UK was confronted on BBC with footage of handcuffed and blindfolded Uyghurs and so on, which made him sort of squirm live on TV. It did not go across well in diplomatic circles. And now the first sign of retaliation that we see, a sort of public one, is the Premiership is now pulled in China and is not being broadcast for the rest of the season.
Now, that's a very big deal. Actually, the season only finished. The season finishes next week, Peter, but a new season will start. The point is that it's interesting you should raise that. I was aware that the Premier League match was not shown, and it was a big night for the Premier League and for Liverpool. But hundreds of millions of Chinese fans, also Chinese sponsors, are very much involved, and they would pay quite substantial sums of money to be able to get the Premier League on television. The question of the Uyghurs, I saw the interview on the Andrew Marr show with the Chinese ambassador, who is a very formidable chap, a Chinese ambassador to London. And the question of the Uyghurs was raised, and it is a good, gives you an insight into this Chinese mindset at the moment. These people are forcibly sterilized. They're held in camps. They are Muslims, of course, an ethnic minority. They are held in appalling conditions. What the BBC showed the ambassador was footage from a drone that purported to be Uyghurs. He denied that it was. But it does give you an idea of how far from us they are in the way they treat their citizens.
Yes, I think nothing has shocked the international communities quite as much as the treatment of Uyghurs and the other Muslim minorities in Xinjiang. This story has been going on for since basically 2016, 2017. It really became quite a big international news story in 2018, but didn't really sort of seem to capture public attention until recent months. Now it's certainly it's front and foremost to many people's minds, when they're on diplomatic minds, business people and so on. I mean, the stories are horrific, like you say. The forced sterilizations, since they've started this clampdown in the last 3 years, they say that birth rates in the province have plummeted by 84% due to a combination of forced sterilizations, abortions, and plus the incarceration of the male population. Also, a shipment that was going from Xinjiang, that was destined for New York last month, was found to contain 13 tons of human hair that we don't know came from, but presumably was farmed from these camps and was then going to be sold on the market in the US. So there's 500,000 people have been sentenced to long-term prison sentences. There's forced labor. There's state orphanages where they separate the children from their parents and they bring them up in a Han Chinese sort of heavily indoctrinated world where they're not allowed to speak their language, they're not allowed to practice their religion, they're not allowed to embrace their culture. So it's definitely, you know, it's been called all kinds of, is it cultural genocide, is it demographic genocide, or is it pure, as increasing voices are saying, is it just genocide?
Now, on the question of Hong Kong, Peter, the British have retaliated to the new law that the Chinese have enforced in Hong Kong. The British won't now have their agreement, extradition agreement. They've said they've cancelled that indefinitely. There is a new hard line. There are elections due in Hong Kong. The other big move, and I'd like to explain how this has been perceived in China, is that Britain has offered 200,000 Hong Kongers the right to citizenship, and perhaps they will extend that even wider to hundreds of thousands more. That appears to have angered the Chinese greatly.
As a token that really has irritated the Chinese, and they see that it usurps their sovereignty. And they find it quite insulting. It's in total, it could be up to 3 million, 2.9 million people who could be eligible for this British National Overseas Passport. Priti Patel in the UK launched details yesterday. I have to say it's received with some cynicism among the pro-democracy camp in Hong Kong. She said that fees yesterday will not be waived for people. So there's a minimum of administrative fees for any of these applicants would be about £9,000. They will not be entitled to any kind of government funding or like a welfare or asylum fund or anything when they're there. So they have to show that they're entirely self-sufficient for at least 6 months, plus having this legal fee. So basically people think you need maybe 30,000-40,000 more pounds sterling before you could embark on this trip. And your average Hong Kong sort of 23 or 24 year old protester sort of laughs at that and just thinks that it seems that the Conservative Party is welcoming with open arms a certain kind of Hong Kong protester, but not not the average Joe Soap who doesn't have that kind of money to put into an immigration program.
Are those young Hong Kong, that generation of protesters, those people who were born after the agreement in 1997 for the handover, where there would be one country, two systems, people born after that are not really automatically entitled to anything. Are that generation now fearful of this, what appears to be a rise in Chinese nationalism and a more aggressive stance all over the world, whether it's the South China Sea and Taiwan, whether it's trade, whether it's the stealing of intellectual property, or indeed the whole Huawei issue?
Yes, in Hong Kong, there's a great deal of fear. I think people can see what their future holds by basically, you can hop on a train in Hong Kong and in 20 minutes you're in Shenzhen. and you're in, it's a glistening city, very modern and so on, but it's on the other side of the border. And there you have, you know, to all intents and purposes, it looks like a very modern city, but there's no opportunity to criticize the government. There's no room for dissent. There's no room for civil society, independent media. There's no free access to the internet and so on. So all these sort of rights are curtailed. People can live and do live in a kind of a peaceful manner and get on. They can get, they can lead prosperous and healthy lives and so on. But the red line is you do not ever challenge the authority of the Communist Party. You do not show signs of dissent, or they will come down on you like a ton of bricks. And that is what's happening, as we see now in Hong Kong. Very quickly, overnight, it transformed from that. As soon as that national security law was introduced, it just totally overhauled the legal framework that basically any sign of dissent or criticism or any sort of voices for calling for greater autonomy would be a national security crime, and therefore you could be then tried, you could be imprisoned for life, you could be brought to Chinese mainland courts and brought in there, including not just, and this is the Irish consulate in Hong Kong has issued this warning on its website too, that Article 38 of this national security law says people can be held found guilty of worldwide. So anybody globally around the world who says anything that the Chinese government considers to be undermining its national security can be charged under this law. So if you say something, or say some person organizes a demonstration outside the GPO or something, if they then return to Hong Kong or transit through Hong Kong,
yes,
they could then be detained in Hong Kong, and they could be whisked across the border to the mainland system, where of course there isn't the common law judicial system. There's a very opaque sort of Communist Party run judicial system where the conviction rate is in excess of 99%. You know, so where people, it is tends to be sort of seen as doing the bidding of the party more than any kind of independent judicial system.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss. There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode, and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Now, if we reflect on the fish and chips and the pint in the pub with David Cameron, George Osborne talking, who was the Chancellor of the Exchequer in those days, talking about a golden era. This is only 2015, 2016. Was there a complete misreading of President Xi and the Communist Party as it now is?
And I think that there was to a large extent, and that's still going. And certainly, the European Commission has put their hands up and said that they, you know, the European across the board have been naive in their approach to China and have granted them too much leeway. Have expected more reciprocal arrangements, and certainly into they're not even. I mean, when you talk to Chinese or European diplomats and so on, they're not even beyond the human rights situation. They're talking about trade issues and so on. They say that it's such an unlevel playing field, and even getting worse and worse per the, as years go by, that there is they feel like there's very little room to sort of broker negotiations with them. They're still hopeful, of course. China's a massive economy, and this is something that many people, human rights activists and so on, have been complaining about for a long time, that people from Europe and North America and so come here. And first and foremost is always trade, and the human rights situation runs sort of is very much in the background. It's something that's potentially paid lip service to, and in the EU, we're able to kind of individual countries are able to hide behind the European Commission and say that's done on a sort of multilateral sort of framework arrangement. We don't have to engage on that. So you can basically just get on with business and not have to confront the stark realities of a million people in internment camps in Xinjiang and so on. So that is certainly changing, and people are realizing now that it obviously China that invests more in the West and it becomes more embedded in the West in many ways is going to not just get its capital is not going to be embedded, but its way of life, its systems of governance and everything, as we see with these legislations with Huawei itself, how it just entangles itself in our lives. And it's very difficult then to disentangle it. So you want to have a fairly clear sense of what the rules of engagement are before you allow that to happen.
Now, Huawei is fascinating on many levels, Peter. First of all, the British decision to change their mind and to phase Huawei out of their 5G system has really, it appears, upset the Chinese. It's a decision that the United States made first. About Huawei. Is Donald Trump a gift to the Chinese Communist Party?
Yes, definitely. He's overall, there's I think in diplomatic circles and so on here and among Communist Party people that you speak to, they enjoy his presence. You know, sometimes they find him vulgar and offensive, and they think he's racist and towards them and so on. But they think he doesn't do in the long term much harm for China on the international stage, and has actually opened a fairly large window of opportunity over the last few years. So what we see here, what we see is China's increasing assertiveness and moving in the global stage. Part of that is this sense of opportunism now that there's a reshuffling, sort of a whole new world order sort of coming into the making, that the sun is setting on the power of the American empire. And that now is definitely their chance to restack the decks a bit. So that's certainly part of it. Part of it, though, also is coming from domestic pressures internally, that they're dealing with crisis management here, and that if they feel that if they're more abrasive, if they're out there confronting on the world stage, if the economy continues to motor, that they can then keep at bay issues from domestic issues and keep the population sort of in support generally and keep their legitimacy strong. So it's a combination of those things.
They better get the Premier League back. I can tell you, Peter, the party could be in trouble on that one. I just want to ask you, sorry, go on, finish. I'm sorry, I interrupt you.
It's amazing how much things like the Premier League really do just irritate your average person here when that's moved off. There was a precedent here for this when last year when the National Basketball Association, one of the officials, tweeted support for the Hong Kong protesters. And of course, that since the NBA has been off the air here since, the NBA say they've lost millions and millions of dollars in business here since that has happened. So it's definitely it's a go to one of the first things that the Chinese think of, how to sort of on one level just to strike a retaliatory note, but it really does affect the your average person who doesn't normally get involved in politics, and then all of a sudden can't watch the game and goes, what the hell is going on? So it's a bit of a tricky one for them.
We have to get our priorities right. Now, if Donald Trump is a gift for China, is Brexit another gift? And Boris.
Yes, so I think Brexit was welcomed here because they do not like to see United Europe, the strong 28 countries together. It doesn't suit their diplomatic approach. And consistently now, they will always go to Europe and they will always try to sort of to offer specific deals to countries, knowing that shouldn't be permissible under the European framework and so on, but trying to essentially divide and conquer. And certainly we've seen countries like Italy signing up to the Belt and Road Initiative recently. Countries like we see Hungary and so on are very supportive of China. So they will... and at different times that we see other countries coming in. So there was definitely an approach there to divide and conquer. They don't like to see a very strong united Europe. Angela Merkel is now, of course, coming towards the end of her career. She has been in diplomatic circles here sort of quite criticized from the European side for being very soft on China herself. There's all sorts of... essentially, people presume that the reason for that is that German trade is with China is her key priority, and that she wants to keep that. She wants to keep that as a forefront. Now, of course, since this month, Germany holds the presidency of the European Union, and they are now very much in the spotlight about what they're going to do with this EU China relationship, and they have pledged now to recalibrate that relationship and to come up with a whole new set of ground rules for how the relationship is going to work with China. So that'll be an interesting few months to see now as they go, because all of this, as you say, all of these situations from Huawei to Xinjiang to South China Sea and everything have been laid bare. There isn't really, I mean, for China's intentions are just patently clear to everybody. So now is the time to say, well, you just to sort of come up with some kind of framework where they say what you can accept and what we cannot accept.
Yes, and Germany have to make the same choice on Huawei as the UK did, because their own telecom system has, as of now, stayed with Huawei rather than abandoning it. So that would be a very, very significant call.
Yes, I see France has followed the UK suit. I think most European countries will. Now with such intense pressure on them now, with such a big spotlight on it, the risks are quite high, obviously.
Can we just get into the detail of Huawei? I mean, as I understand it, Huawei, it makes software and hardware for the 5G system. Huawei, the objection being that it is a company that is... effectively controlled by the Chinese Communist Party, as all Chinese companies are. Is that the issue? Therefore, the Americans would have nothing to do with it. Britain said they would stick with it and then backed off. Now the rest of Europe have decisions to make. Can you explain what Huawei is?
Sure. That's certainly a key part of it. It's in one way you have to say that you have to take your hat off to Huawei. It's a very impressive company. It's invested hugely in R&D. Every year it secures more patents than everybody else put together in this telecommunications sector. It's very professional. It's able to come in, like the two European leaders are Nokia and Siemens. It's able to come in and do essentially what they can do, and sometimes better, for 30 or 40% cheaper. It has wiped the boards of American competition and other competition around the world. So it is a stronger company, and it's coming in cheaper. Now, the allegations will be certainly first and foremost that it has received funding along the way and helped up and got unfair sort of practices yes. there from the government and from the People's Liberation Army. The founder itself used to work, was an engineer for the People's Liberation Army. So the two main concerns, I suppose, is one that this, you know, this is going to be, 5G is going to be integral to all every part of our lives, from everything from traffic lights to self-driving cars to, you know, to not just not just your mobile phones, but to you know, the Internet of Things, all your household appliances and everything will be run by this 5G. And the propensity for any kind of backdoor situation where there could be sort of malware or spyware or any kind of access yes. to information at any point is wide open there, and there's continual there'll be continual updates and so on. So that's one key aspect, that there is a potential for that. The other one is that we see the way China behaves, for, say, for example, when in Canada, when the Huawei chief financial executive was arrested on for sanctions charges, they in China here, they just arrested two Canadians for it, just, and they've held them in prison for more than 18 months, and just pure hostage diplomacy, and have just said that until the Huawei lady is released, these guys are going to sit in prison cells with no lawyer and no hope of getting out. So the fear is you know, this is how they behave on when they feel like they have been besmirched in any way in these disputes. If a country has Huawei systems totally embedded in their infrastructure, yes. and then you have a bilateral dispute with China, the possibility for them just to flick the switch and turn off your network at any point, or to threaten to do that, is certainly a live one worth considering. So that's what governments advise, not to leave yourself susceptible to that.
Just a couple of questions, Peter, before we finish. China's venturing into the world, particularly to Africa, has always intrigued me. And how deeply involved with Africa and in Africa are the Chinese? And how does that benefit them, strengthen them in many ways?
Hugely in there. They have invested, they've been investing there for decades, you know, even yes. back 20-30 years ago. They had this thing called stadium diplomacy, where in every capital of African capital you would have a football stadium was built by the Chinese. But certainly as they have become a richer power now, and with these, you know, the $1 trillion Belt and Road infrastructure project, that's basically a vehicle for them to lend money and to invest funds internationally. Africa has been a key focus for that. They now are by far the biggest, way ahead of IMF or World Bank or the European governments. They're by far the biggest lender to African yes. states. Now, of course, that's coming back to hurt at some points now, particularly with the recession in the coronavirus times and so on, that many of these countries are now unable to pay back their loans and so on. It's the allegations are that this is debt diplomacy. This is always kind of, it's they're lending large sums of money to governments that they on the basic knowing that they will not be able to repay them, and then that they will have increased leverage over these countries. China rejects these allegations, of course, but they now are in a situation where many of these loans are not coming back or not on schedule, and there is a certain amount of pushback for it. I would say on the other side, though, there's having interviewed some African entrepreneurs and so on last year on this, a lot of them are very welcoming from this, and they prefer, you know, they think that the Chinese are more pragmatic to deal with. They come in, they lend money. The British and the French and the US said they came in, it was development aid. It had all sorts of strings attached about it, and so, and it was they call it sort of colonial sort of relic approach, whereas they think the Chinese side is a bit, many of them that I spoke to were appreciative and said it's commercial sort of and it's commercial banking, and it's cultivating a new generation, a young generation of African entrepreneurs, which wasn't there before. So there is, it's not just a simple debt diplomacy thing. There is a lot of benefit to Chinese investment in Africa. Obviously, it's a two-sided coin.
Right. In the event of what we believe will be another Cold War with China rather than the Soviet Union as the other protagonist, the question of Taiwan, Peter, given their aggressive moves in Hong Kong, is Taiwan's position now and a little less secure, and surely the West and the United States in particular could not let Taiwan go, as it were.
Yes, it's something that is raising a lot of concerns in the neighborhood. The level of military activity in the Taiwan Straits lately by Chinese ships and so on is intense and has escalated dramatically. The annual Parliamentary Assembly every year issues a statement, a resolution saying that our priority is the peaceful liberation of Taiwan. This year, they issued the statement saying our priority is the liberation of Taiwan. And they omitted the word peaceful for the first time, which, caused a lot of worry across the states. The prognosis for a military battle there would be grim. Obviously there is the understanding that the United States would be obliged to intervene. It's not entirely clear they would do that. But Taiwan itself is very well equipped. It's an island. It's kind of hard to access. And it has been preparing for this for 70 years. So it is very well equipped to. Of course, it would not in the long term be able to withstand a full on Chinese assault. But it would certainly be able to put up a very long, prolonged battle, which would be an absolutely horrendous scene to witness. And there would be a huge loss of life on both sides. People say, and it would not be a foregone conclusion that that China would be able to take it very quickly or easily at all. So this kind of obviously this Cold War terminology of mutually assured destruction to a degree is sort of keeping the peace, I think, into a certain, and certainly the the situation that the United States will be obliged to intervene. There was a feeling that there was more posturing done under the Trump administration because Trump was very much more about doing business than concerned about rights for Taiwanese citizens or so on.
Yes. More transactional. Transactional is the word. What can you do for me?
The art of the deal. So the feeling is in Taiwan, they're looking forward or hoping for a Biden presidency where they think they will have a more stable hand at the helm and they'll have a clearer expression of support.
Just a final question. 6%, I think, of the population in China are members of the Communist Party. What do the people of China know about this? And now that they haven't got access to the Premier League, they might start to think a bit more about these things. Well, in terms of public discourse, there is none, I take it.
The public discourse goes on online platforms like the equivalent of WeChat and so on. WeChat, the equivalent of WhatsApp, and different places like that. People can't speak directly; they have to speak obliquely, but they can get the message across. Last night was hilarious. I was watching hundreds of thousands of messages going through where people were trying to guess what was in the documentation that the consulate officials were burning and making all kinds of gags about what it could be and what China was trying to cover up. So that's all there. If you go to the state of the CCTV, it's called the state news channel. It is hardcore propaganda that has 14 minutes of Xi Jinping on for the opening of the news. It basically doesn't. It doesn't look very different from North Korean television. So that's the kind of state apparatus. But on the mobile phone sort of thing, on different channels of that, there's a lot of information coming out. People subtly get their views held. And they kind of know. I mean, they have this love-hate relationship with the U.S. Many of them, still have studied there, or their children are studying there, or they've worked there, and so on. And they have this, there's a huge amount of investment there, including, I mean, when you go to the foreign ministry briefing, you have some foreign ministry official up there ranting and raving about how horrible America is and how despotic it is and what a nasty dictatorship it is. And then you find out that they have a property in Los Angeles and their son is in university there and so on. Xi Jinping's own daughter went to Harvard and was recently just finished. And most of the senior, the higher echelons of the Communist Party, all of their sons and daughters are educated in the U.S. So this is a big fear for them now because you see Mike Pompeo, this Secretary of State, had said recently that he's considering putting travel bans on all the 90 million Communist Party officials and their family members, which could wipe out, that's 300 million people who travel back and forth to America, or quite a lot of them. quite some time. So that would be that would have a big impact, and a big impact on American education too, because I think they are essentially the big contributors to the coffers of the of American academia.
Of course. Okay, Peter, we're very grateful to you for joining us from China, and I hope you get the Premier League back very soon.
So do I.
It might not be your thing, but
it is.
Let's hope the Chinese Communist Party can survive cutting the Premier League off from their yes. population. We're very grateful to you, Peter Goff. Peter's reports in the Irish Times are always fascinating, and this China story is really the biggest story in the world right now. Thanks to Peter. Thanks to all of you for listening. That's all we have time for now. We'll talk to you soon.